Now, many of the ethical debates, moral debates of our society, and religious debates are about the world around us rather than about heaven and how to get there. They're debates of the greenies versus the developers, from wood chopping to seal harvesting, from whaling to culling kangaroos, from our carbon footprints to ZPG, you know, zero population growth, from building dams to mining uranium, from wearing fur coats to experimenting on animals in order to produce new drugs. The debates that are raging around us are about this world and our place in it and how we use it. The developers want to utilise the resources of the world. The greenies want to preserve the resources of this world. Sometimes the debates are purely pragmatic and utilitarian, managing the impact of kangaroos or rabbits or cane toads. But increasingly the debates are couched in absolute, moral and very emotional terms. What right have you to destroy? How can we spend our grandchildren's inheritance? The era of speciesism and all the philosophy that has gone around that, and the denial of the right to own or to use any other creature and animal. And so the debates of the world around us have become expressions of alternative and competitive philosophies. There have been for some years the advocates of Buddhism. Interesting, I saw an advertisement for a TV show coming up about Tibet. Tibet, of course, being very much in the news in terms of the Olympic relay and the rest, but this was a nature study of Tibet, and Tibet being one of the most important ecosystems in the world. And it went on to say how the Tibetan people for years have lived in peace and harmony, untroubling the environment that they're in. They don't mention that the Tibetan people have lived in abject poverty and starvation in the process. That's not mentioned. They don't mention that the Chinese government have actually fed them and educated for the first time in history. They don't mention the other. It's that love of Buddhism, the mystic idea that we can live in harmony with creation without touching it, without affecting it, without, and of course, the Hinduism that teaches all animal life as being sacred, so that rats, cows, monkeys have the same rights as humans and can destroy the living standards of people around about. I mean, Hinduism can sound lovely, but when your children is starving because of the rats that are eating your food, you've got a big belief problem on your hands. And then there's the deists and materialists who see the world just as a biological machine that has no particular values in itself and can be manipulated without any reference to morality. Cloning, genetically modifying anything that moves. Why can't we do this? It's just a machine that we can recalibrate, we can reorganise, we can restructure. And there are some of whom see humans, though, as the centre of all evolution, and that can run in two opposite directions. On the one hand, because we are the centre and pinnacle of all evolution, then all the world is there for our benefit. Or because we are the pinnacle and end point of evolution, therefore we are responsible to look after and care for all of the world around about us. There are the pantheists, there are the animists who see God in everything, for everything is holy and nothing is to be used by him. It goes on and on. The different varieties of philosophies and religions have different consequences in what we do with the world around about us. And we often fight about this tree or this forest or this river or this dam, not realizing what we're really fighting about is which religion, which ethical moral system are we going to make our decisions based upon? Well, Psalm 104 is a creation psalm. It's about God in creation. And it's a wonderful psalm in praise of God. I'm going to look at it in different sections, as you'll see from your outline today. The first verse or so is just one little section introducing the theme of the whole psalm, and then we'll turn to the major sections. But Jasmine, come up and read for us, please, the first two verses, which gives us the opening theme of the psalm.
Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent.
Well, as with Psalm 103 that we saw last week, the psalm starts and also finishes, like Psalm 103 does, with the psalmist calling upon himself, O my soul, bless the Lord, praise the Lord, bless God by name, bless Yahweh, the Lord, praise my God, because this is the great God. But unlike Psalm 3, it's not a very personal thing. He's praising God for the very public thing, namely of God's majesty. For that is the theme of the whole psalm. It's about God in his majesty, especially as his creation displays his majesty. It's about the splendor and greatness of God seen in creation, because God is clothed in light and has stretched out the heavens like a tent to inhabit. The pictures of the greatness and the splendor and the magnificence and the glory and the majesty of God in creation are going to be compounded upon one upon another. And so the next major section of the psalm, really, it's most of the psalm from verse 2 to verse 30, but we'll divide it into sections, is about God and creation. Jasmine, come again for us, please. As we look at the three sections, God is the creator of all, the provider of all, the sustainer of all. Firstly, though, we'll do God, the creator of all, verses 2 to 9, if you would.
He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down, to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, that they might not again cover the earth.
It's highly poetic, but it follows something of the line of Genesis 1, speaking about light in the first place and then about the creation in its chaotic state. It speaks of heavens and of the waters and the clouds. It speaks of the fire, the earth, the seas, and then down to the mountains and the valleys. But it's very similar to Genesis 1. The phrases like the covering of the deep and the waters above the mountains. See, God created the world and then shaped the world. So in Genesis 1, you see, everything is created, but it was void and without shape. And so God then carved it in verses 2 through to the end of chapter 1 of Genesis 1. Verse 2 and the rest of it is about how God carves it, shaping the chaos of the original created matter into mountains and seas and valleys. And as with Genesis 1, the emphasis on Psalm 104 in this section, the emphasis throughout is upon God and upon his creative sovereignty. He stretches the skies, the heavens out. The winds and the fire are but his servants, his messengers. That little verse being quoted in Hebrews chapter 1 as a sign of the difference between God the Son and the angels. The angels, the messengers of God, are but winds and fire, whereas the Son of God created all things. And the earth, well, he set, he covered, he rebuked, he appointed, he set the boundary. Over and over, it's God who's doing it. It's God who set it up. It's God who covers it. It's God who rebukes it. It's God who appoints it. It's God who sets the boundaries of creation, of the waters coming on the land, so that it never again will be destroyed and swallowed up by waters. The sea may rise, but it will never cover all the earth, because God has established where it will be. Secondly, He is the provider of all things. So in verses 10 to 23, we see Yahweh as the provider of all.
You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine and bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly. The cedars of Lebanon that he planted, in them the birds built their nests. The stork has a home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the rock badgers. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness, and it is night, when all the beasts of the forest creep about. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labour until the evening.
Again, it's the impression is everything. This psalm is about all of creation, about everything in creation. And the impression is that everything comes from the hand of God. The water for the beasts and the birds of the air, the earth, the fruit, the grass and the plants for the cattle and for the man, the trees for the birds, the mountains for the goats and the rock badgers. It's actually the hyraxes, but most of us don't know what a hyrax is, so it's translated rock badgers, which doesn't help us much in Australia because I'm not sure we know what rock badgers are all that well either. But hey, it's a, you know, it's one of those translations. Little furry animals like rabbits. Anyway, for the mountains, it's they're there for them. And the seasons and the times are marked out by the moon, and the day is marked out by the sun. So there is night and there is day, and the night is for the wild animals to roam and to eat, and the day is for man to go about his work. God has ordered the world to work, to exist, to function, providing for both man and beast. The world is not a chaos. It's not random. It's not meaningless. It's not a nightmare existence of we don't know what's going to happen next. It is God who has ordered the world that may be inhabited, we're told in Isaiah 45, verse 7. But notice in this little section of our psalm today that the wine has been made to gladden the heart of man, and also the bread gladdens our heart, and the oil for us. That is, there is pleasure in the creation for us. Expressive pleasure, more pleasure than is needed to gladden the heart of man. Now, I mention it to you for a couple of reasons. One is because I'm a teetotaler. Another is because in my youth I used to teach wrongly that wine and alcohol was a bad thing. The Bible teaches it's a good thing. While I retain my status as a teetotaler and would encourage other people to, because alcohol has got a terrible grip on our society and people need to protest against it, and because alcohol, well, we've now discovered that produces cancer, all kinds of cancers of the bowel, of the breast cancer and mouth cancer, etc. But alcohol is really bad on 1,000 fronts. I could give you quite a talk on alcohol, but the scriptures say it's created by God. It's good. There's nothing wrong with it. Take heroin. Is heroin a good thing or a bad thing? Heroin is a good thing. It's created by God for man's benefit. That we misuse it is a different thing to saying it is bad. It is actually very good. I understand from my medical friends that is a palliative for palliative care. Heroin is the best of all the substances to be giving to people as they're dying in pain. The only side effect that is bad about heroin is you get addicted to it. If you're going to die, that's really not the problem anymore. So it really is a good substance to be used at the right time, the right way. It's a dreadful substance to be used. But the substance is not wrong. It's not bad. Wine is given. as part of the joys of life that God has for us to have and to enjoy. And so that we misuse it terribly and have now addicted something like 5% of our population, well, that's very sad. That's very tragic. And if you've got a problem in this area, please take action, do something about it, because it really is dreadful. But, my friends, its substance itself is good, created by God for our enjoyment. And you'll notice work is there, because God has created humans to work. He's created us to work, and so the sun is the time for us to work, as the night is the time for us to rest. That is, God has created the rhythm of life for us, which our electric lights, I may say, has disturbed that rhythm fairly severely, so that we try and work our 24 hours and have terrible troubles balancing work and family because we've lost the sense of the rhythm of life that God has created for us to enjoy. But thirdly, not only has God created everything, not only has God provided for us, but God is the sustainer of everything, of all as well. Verses 24 to 30.
O Lord, how manifold are your works! In wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. These all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground.
Thank you, Jasmine. It's all about God creating, making all the creatures. But now, it also especially is about God sustaining all the creatures. I mean, the sea is the scene of innumerable sea creatures. I mean, we haven't come to anywhere near the extent of the knowledge of the different creatures that are in the sea. It's the place where the ships play and Leviathan plays. Leviathan is the ancient word for the large sea monster. Sometimes the crocodile, sometimes a whale. It's just the big things that play around in the sea. Some suggest dolphins. Yet all the creatures, whatever they might be in this world, look to God for food in due season. For God provides for the life of all of them with his open hand, and when he hides himself, they die. For it is God who brings life, and it is God who brings death. For life comes from the Spirit of God animating the dust that we are all made of. All creatures are made of dust, and all creatures participate in the spirit that gives life. The word spirit is the word breath. It's as you breathe, you live, as you live, you breathe. And it is the breath that comes from God that animates this dust that enables me to be alive. But should God cease to sustain me with the provisions of food and drink, in time I die. So, with this great reminder of the opening chapter of Genesis, the psalmist reflects upon God and creation and humans. And in the concluding few verses here, verses 31 to 35, the psalmist thinks about what it means for him and humanity in a strange way.
May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. Who looks on the earth and it trembles, who touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being. May my meditation be pleasing to him, for I rejoice in the Lord. Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord.
In verses 31-32, there are two themes about Yahweh in creation. They are glory and joy. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. May the glory of the Lord, who creates and provides and sustains everything, endure forever. For look at the magnificence, look at the splendor, look at the almost prodigal expression of God's generosity to us in the beauty of the world that is around about us, the enormity of the mountains, the delicacy of the snowflake, the power of the tiger and the beauty of the sunset, from the delicate balance of ecosystems to the sheer pleasures of taste and smell and sight and sound. Look at the magnificence and splendor of all creation, but look and see the glory of God that is displayed in the creation, that is unveiled in it, that his glory may endure forever. I went a couple of weeks ago and had a week off down to Canberra and looked at a series of landscapes in an exhibition that is down there. And you cannot help but see the glory of the created world in the beauty of the landscapes. But as you look at them from person to person, you start to say, wasn't Turner a terrifically gifted painter and artist? Wasn't Monet a terrific... You actually give praise to the creator of the artwork. Beautiful as the water lilies and haystacks and the rest may be, magnificent is the man who could see it and could capture it and could present it for you on the canvas. The artist is greater than the painting. That's one of the great things to see. Well, look at the world. Isn't it a magnificent sunset? Yes, but who made it? Look at the world. Isn't this a terrific view of the ocean and the lakes? And yes, but who made them? Look at the wonders of the Barrier Reef and all the colours that are everywhere of the coral and of the fit. But who made them? The glory of the Creator is infinitely greater than the creation he's made, and the glory of his creation is enormous. And so we praise the glory of the God, for how far greater is he than his creation. He looks and touches the world and it smokes and trembles. Interesting little verse there, referring back presumably to Mount Sinai, where God came and visited his people. And there the smoke rose up from the mountain and the mountain shook at the voice of God, and terrified were the people at Yahweh the Creator in his creation. But there is the second theme of verse 31. May the Lord rejoice in his works. His works are good and to be rejoiced in. The world is not evil. It's not Maya, the Hindu view of the world. Maya means deception. You talk to a Hare Krishna or any Hindu here, they'll tell you the world is a deception. It's a physical con to take you away from spiritual reality. And its pleasures are only there so as to seduce you away from the spiritually hard regime of touching with the real reality, namely the spirit. But no, here the Bible does not see the world as Maya. It's not a deception, it's a reality. And its beauty is there, and its pleasures are there. He rejoiced to make them, but notice, may God rejoice in them, is the wish prayer of the psalmist. The psalm doesn't talk of us rejoicing in them, but of God rejoicing in them. Our joy is in the God who made them. But the prayer wish of verse 31 is that God may rejoice in the works of his hands. May he who has made it all as wonderful as is find pleasure in what he has done. For the psalmist, there is a different twofold theme than the glory and the joy. It's of praise and meditation. He will sing praises to Yahweh, his God, to the creator and sustainer of all things, the God who finds his pleasure in his creation, the God whose glory is seen in his creation. Verse 33, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being. Singing is a way of expressing our own emotions. It's a way of feeling emotions. It's a way of creating emotions. Music is profoundly the emotional response. And when I see the glory of God in his creation, then I express that joy that I have in God by song, by singing and making music to him who is so great in all that he does. But it's not only singing. He meditates, he thinks. The word meditation in the Bible never means sitting in the corner in a lotus kind of position and going om, om, om. That is not meditation. The word meditate in the Bible means think. It's a kind of fairly basic thing that some humans have been known to do occasionally. Think, consider, reason, work out. And so I will think about God's work in creation, such as this psalm is a meditation on God in his creation. And may this psalm, this thinking, be acceptable to God, thinking about how wonderful God is, how wise and wonderful and powerful and great, which leads him to rejoice. But his joy is in the Lord, not in the creation, but in the Lord who created it. And so he doesn't sing praise to the creation, but praise to the Creator for the creation. But then comes an almost shock in the last verse, verse 35. It just seems to kind of change the character of the whole psalm. Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. That comes out of left field, doesn't it? You're not really expecting that to be said at this point. There's all kinds of ways in which you could finish this psalm up. And in fact, if the 35a had been left out and had just gone from 34 to bless the Lord, O my soul, praise the Lord, you wouldn't miss the first half of verse 35 at all, would you? Just is there, suddenly. And yet, when you think of God and his creation, when you sing his praises and rejoice in him, when you think of man and his maker, you realize the offense, the rudeness, the insult, the blasphemy of people rebelling against God. That humans who have such a privileged place in this magnificent creation and such a wonderful creation to live in, such a generous, kind God to live for, that humans would turn their back on their Creator and ignore him and rebel against him, it beggars belief. And so the psalmist wishes that the disordered part of God's creation, namely the sinful heart, that sin and sinners who reject God would be removed from this magnificent world of God, so that all may praise and bless and call upon, he calls upon himself to do it, to bless, to praise the Lord. For the God of creation deserves all praise, not sin, not rebellion. Okay, well, here's Psalm 104. Not a complicated psalm, a little longer than some of the other ones we've looked at, but a wonderful psalm of creation. Let's consider what living by that psalm looks like. For the psalm gives us an attitude to the world, to God, and to ourselves. It gives us an attitude to the world because it's God's world. It's an ordered working system that God has created. It's good and it's enjoyable and it's dependent upon God. It's not self-existing nor self-sustaining. It has to be worked and worked in. Now, each of these things, you see, has implications for the way of which we live. It's God's world, not ours. And so we live and use it to please him. We're responsible to him for it. It means that we don't worship it or any part of it, for he is the creator and God over all. It's an ordered working system. It means that scientific inquiry is possible. You don't get science from Hinduism. You don't get science from Buddhism. You wouldn't get science from animism, because they do not see it as the ordered working system of a God that has created it and stands over and apart from it. It means that we are to be concerned not just for the parts, but for the whole. It's good and it's enjoyable. It means that we're not to reject it. The food, the drink, the physical pleasures of the world, God has created for the animals to enjoy and for us. So many religions of the world are anti-physical, anti-pleasure, but biblical Christianity will always be concerned to see the world as a good thing that God has created for us to enjoy. And it's dependent upon God, which means we can never take this world for granted. It's not a machine. Earthquake, fire, drought, flood, famine, they could all happen to us at a stroke, and we must always be looking to God, saying thank you for every meal that we receive, and praying that he would continue to provide the rain in good seasons and the sun. It's not just this material machine. It is God who gives every good thing to us. And so the psalm gives us then not only an attitude to the world, but an attitude towards God. We are to live in wonder and praise, joy and awe of our almighty, wise, generous Creator. We are to live in faith and trust and dependence upon him, giving thanks for our food and asking for our health and well-being. We are to love and admire his kindness and his thoughtfulness and his generosity. And we desire that he might find joy in all his creation, including us. And we must see ourselves in terms of someone different. For we were created in his image to care for his world. That is our responsibility. The animals don't care for us. We care for them. For we are the ones in his image who treat his world as he treats his world. And so we're part of that dependent world. We're not self-made. We're not self-appointed. But we have been God-appointed and are answerable to him. And we live and work and rejoice in his creation, balancing out our work and rest and enjoying the good things that he's given to us for his purposes and praising him forever for what he has done. There is a hymn that I will not sing for you, for your benefit. A great hymn that is based on this psalm. I read this hymn to you. As I read it, think about the psalm, because that's obviously where the hymn writer has got it from. Let me conclude with this hymn, and next time you sing it in church somewhere, think back to Psalm 104. O worship the King, all glorious above, O gratefully sing of his power and his love, our shield and defender, the Ancient of Days, pavilioned in splendor and girded with praise. O tell of God's might, O sing of God's grace, whose robe is the light and whose canopy space, whose chariots of wrath the deep thunder clouds form, and dark is God's path on the wings and the storm. The earth with its store of wonders untold, almighty thy power hath founded of old, hath established it fast by a changeless decree, and round it has cast like a mantle the sea. Thy bountiful care, what tongue can recite? It breathes in the air, it shines in the light. It streams from the hills, it descends to the plain, and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. Frail children of dust, and feeble as frail, in thee do we trust, nor find thee to fail. Thy mercies, how tender, how firm to the end, our Maker, Defender, Redeemer, and Friend. Andrew.